The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, funding partner to Ayers Holdings and Transcorp for their $1.1 billion US dollar acquisition of OML17. That's Africa Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP. Welcome to The Money Show this evening. Good to have you with us on this Friday night. Between 7 and 8, we'll review some of the best interviews from the week that has been. Look forward to sharing those with you. We've had some wonderful insights, some wonderful guests, and some really, really valuable contributions this week. Lots of entertainment as well. Lots of really lovely guests. And if you'd like to hear those, between 7 and 8. If not, if you can't make it, our podcast is available within minutes of the show ending each and every single day, most days. And you get that on our website on 702.co.za or capetalk.co.za or from the place that you like to get your podcasts from. There are lots of platforms that carry podcasts and we're on those. And so you'll find The Money Show there. And share it with your friends because we like to tell the stories of money and business in the from the world of the economy and money and help you make better sense of your money every day. I mean, that's what our key motivation is. We're going to talk in a moment to the extraordinary demands that have been placed by Eskom workers. Well, members of the National Union of Mine Workers and NUMSA, who have got members who work in Eskom. And there's some quite extraordinary requests or demands. They're demands. So we'll talk about those and the process of negotiation when it comes to these demands. We'll pick up with Andrew Bryson, our market commentator at Sunland Private Wealth this evening, as the JSE came within just a smelling distance of a record. Smelling distance it was. Smelling distance. Mark Sack is the managing director at Sally Williams Fine Foods. We'll talk to Mark Sack about the global expansion of Sally Williams and then Brutal Biz Quiz between about 10, 2 and 7 o'clock this evening. Welcome to The Money Show.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
I must, before we get progressed too far, just tell you about some public relations I've been subjected to. Usually, public relations is the sort of public relations. I've got to word this carefully because there are lots of lovely public relations practitioners who do a lovely job. But a lot of what we receive on The Money Show is rubbish. And it's misguided, and it's misdirected, and it's poorly done. And it's looking for attention, which it doesn't get. Occasionally, one gets past the goalie. But generally speaking, public relations practitioners do a nice job. But a lot of it is rubbish. A lot of it is absolute rubbish. But I got a piece of public relations today that, to my mind, is one of the finest I've ever received. I was talking to the Citrus Growers Association of Southern Africa the other day, and we were talking about the huge exports of citrus fruit, and we're just talking about just how wondrous it is and huge growth coming through in Mpumalanga and in the Eastern Cape and other parts of the country, and citrus increasingly popular, of course, and finding good markets. And I made a throwaway comment. I just said, you know what? I'm so glad they're exporting grapefruit. Could they export all the grapefruit? Because I don't like grapefruit. So I get a letter signed by the chairman and the chief executive of the Citrus Growers Association of Southern Africa. You know that when you get a letter, it's a brief. It's not a letter, it's a brief. And I thought I braced myself. And it said, we'd like to thank you for the airtime you've given us in the citrus industry. It really helps with positioning. That's nice. We thought we would educate you on the fine art of grapefruit consumption by sending you a box of Star Ruby grapefruit. And it was attached to a box, about 30 kilograms of grapefruit. And they encouraged me to try it, and they encouraged me to try a 14-day test, and they promised me I'll get terribly clever, and even my hair will feel better. But as I have so little hair, I did try grapefruit, and I haven't changed my opinion on the grapefruit, but my colleagues have cleaned out the box of grapefruit completely. So clearly I am the idiot in this particular dynamic here. But it was just such a wonderful piece of public relations where somebody hears something that they don't like and they can get cross and they can phone you up and rant and rage and swear, and they're entitled to do that. Or they can just be, all right, we see you. Try this. And it's a very smart piece of work. So well done to Cornel Panamarev, the chairman of the Citrus Growers Association. My colleagues like grapefruit. You can send more to them. I don't like Aston Martins, and I don't like beachfront bungalows in Clifton, and I don't like expensive hotel nights and first-class world travel. I don't like those things. So if you're good at PR, you'll send me all of those things. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
Have you seen the Eskom workers' wage demands? I mean, if it wasn't so serious, you might think it was April the 1st. I need to get this Africa checked, but I do believe that the staff at Eskom are amongst the best paid in the country. Heaps of benefits and perks that are not available to most people in the private sector. It's an entity that can't produce enough of its only product that it has to sell, and that's electricity. There are too many people employed by Eskom relative to the work that it does. And sure, there are countless issues that are not the fault of the ordinary hardworking Eskom employees, but they are also not the fault of you or I either, as the consumers of their product, who from this month will be paying at least 15% more for the privilege of switching the lights on. Today's Eskom wage demands in that context makes for really interesting reading. Business Maverick has seen the presentation and has reported on the presentation of the full submission made by the National Union of Mine Workers to Eskom. And it outlines the full submission, and its key demands include a 15% salary increase across the board, a one-year agreement rather than be locked into a longer period, a doubling of the housing allowance from 3,500 to 7,000 rand a month, a 40% increase in the car allowance to 10,000 rand a month, and this one tickled my funny bone, a change to ensure that automatic cars, which are currently excluded from the scheme, should be included. An increase in contingency leave, especially to deal with extended family issues. And, I mean, this is in a state utility that is not performing. It's got half a trillion rands worth of debt, give or take. And the union just isn't considering this for a moment. George Mtetwa is the educator and facilitator at the Labour Research Service. I mean, I look at this, George, and I look at this the set of demands, and I go, well, that's typical trade union strategy. You aim as high as you can, you shoot for the stars, and then you compromise from there. And the higher you go, well, then the higher level of compromise you may have to reach. But this, it doesn't look like a serious negotiation at all as an opening point, or is it?
No, look, it's, you know, normally the reason why they aim high is because, first and foremost, is to create a bargaining arena. And subsequent to that also, you know, when we look at 15%, we need to understand 15% of what, you know, because we need to translate it. In each and every percentage, there's a hidden number, you know, because a 15% to someone who's earning, let's say, 8,000 can translate to 1,200 or can translate to 800, you know, or it can even translate less than that. If someone is earning, for example, 4,000, you demand 15%, it can be plus minus 400 or 350, you know. So the issue is, firstly, they get a mandate from their members, 15%. Now, the question, 15% of what? And also, is to create a bargaining arena, because you can't go to the bargaining table with a lower demand. You need to create a bargaining arena, so that you know that if you demand 15%, obvious, that is the opening offer. Those are wage negotiations, take a win and lose. But basically, is to say, we open with 15%, but we know where we want to settle. Equal to that, even the employers, they will come with a lower figure, something like below the inflation, knowing where they want to settle. Mm. So I think that is the idea, that is the approach, that is the strategy.
I mean, and in the 21st century, everybody knows the game, all right? Everybody knows the game. You know the employer is going to come with a low offer, you're going to go with a high offer. And you spend 6 months fighting about this, and eventually you agree on something that nobody's particularly happy with, and that's the correct level. I mean, what a waste of time, isn't it? Or is this an appropriate mechanism? I just look at it and I go to myself, geez, have we not got, you know, can we not be a bit more adult about these things?
I think what can I call it? I think the culture of wage negotiation. Because even the employer, you know, that's how they play the game. You know, no one wants to change the game from both parties. You know, as we are saying, that the employer will come with below inflation offer, the union will come with higher demands, you know. So no one, and it's been happening, you know, it's been like that for many, many years in terms of collective bargaining. So no one wants to come and change the game, you know. So currently what we've seen is that now, if you look at other unions, are not demanding percentage, but they've started demanding rand value. To say, no, we are tired of a percentage, we want a rand value. For example, we are demanding 1,500 rand, or maybe we are demanding 800 rand, whichever is greater. Mm. They can use the percentage. But that's when we see the changes now that are taking place. You know, but the 15%, we'll continuously see the 15%, where most unions will continuously demand the 15%. But equal to that, we have seen some unions taking a shift in terms of demanding rent value, because the idea was that they are members, as they represent members. Members don't understand the percentage, you know. They only understand the rent value. So until one of the parties change the game, maybe we can see something bad. Yes, you're quite right. The union will come 15%, but they will settle at around maybe 10 or 8 or 7%. Hence, the employer will come low, but they will move a little bit, you know, rather than when you look
but
at
what,
the union.
What does this do for labor relations, George, in our country? I mean, it's already the relationship between working people and bosses has always been difficult, and it's the way I think it's probably got to be. But this is surely accentuates that fact and makes it even harder to do business, and the lack of trust on both sides of the wage debate. This doesn't bring anybody together, and it doesn't get everybody to share value. It doesn't encourage employers to say, you know what, guys, let's work differently. Let's think differently. Let's think longer term incentives for productivity. It's a really old fashioned mechanism. Is it time for a change?
Look, it's time for change, but as I've indicated, as long as there's no trust within the relationship, because both parties, for example, the union want to improve the standard living of workers, hence we have the employers who are protecting, you know, in terms of the profits, because they report to the shareholders. So if you look at the bargaining table, even if you are inside the bargaining table, you can see the kind of style that they are using in terms of negotiation. There's no trust, you know, and no one wants to open up, especially on the side of the employer, to say, this is what we're saying, you know. So there's always that trust. As long as there's distrust between the parties, I don't think anything will change now, you know, because there is this fighting. And remember, the most dominating factor in the bargaining table is wages. You know, parties can look at other issues and agree, but when it comes to wages, it's kind of a difficult, you know. No one wants to give and no one wants to take, you know. So there's no trust, because each and every time when they enter the bargaining table, there is that mistrust, you know. And so it will continue. It will continue like that, as I've indicated. It's a culture of how they've been, you know, conducting these wage negotiations. But there is a need for change. I think COVID-19, if you look at the issue of COVID-19 2020, it brought and also many issues emerged. And it also shows that it is time that we change the way the union and the employer interact or engage each other. You know, there is a time now that one needs to change, especially with the economy, the state of the economy that we are in South Africa. You know, therefore, it compels those two parties to engage, to view a labor relation or industrial relation as a mechanism of trying to bring peace within the parties, irrespective of its government as an employer, employer and union.
Thank you to George Mtetwa this evening. He is the educator and facilitator for the Labour Research Service. It's such an antiquated approach, and it's such an unproductive approach, and it's such a fractious approach, and it clearly suits both parties. I mean, otherwise, they wouldn't do it. It suits the trade unions because it allows them to, mouth off about employers. It suits employers because it makes labour unions and workers seem unreasonable. And then you have these big fractious arguments, and people get cross with each other, and people go on strike, and there's a great deal of pain and hurt and everything else in the economy, and it just seems so unnecessary. A bit of reasonableness. Mike Chisler, the economist, pointing out on Twitter this evening that today is 1 year and 3 weeks after the first 3-week lockdown was announced to get our healthcare system ready. Remember that, my fellow South Africans. And we got to the end of 3 weeks and we still weren't ready. So we extended to another 2 weeks. And so we had that 5 weeks of hard lockdown. At that point, hardest lockdown in the world. And we saw cases spike and come off mercifully. And then we saw the second spike come through in December and come off mercifully. And we sort of, you know, waiting to see what happens next. Mike Schüssler's point is that the health system is still not ready. I mean, yes, it held up. It coped at the margins. Jonathan Janssen, the educationalist and the professor this evening, saying the vaccine registration, because he's in the demographic, you see, of over 60s, the vaccine registration process is a complete and confusing management mess. Oh, no, this is a pity. Goodness me, my minister and government, get this thing right. Lives are on the line. And again, Jonathan Janssen, who is not an idiot, if anything, is the exact opposite. And he's struggling. I mean, here's a guy who's, smart guy, who's looking at this thing and going, I don't know how to make this work. And I love the fact that it's an online booking system. And I wonder just how many people over 60 in South Africa have got the devices, the broadband, the stuff that is necessary to help them register for the vaccines. Yeah. Yeah, I tell you what, I've got such a long way to go in so many respects. There's a wonderful story of the most outrageous price for something touted as art. I'll tell you about that in a couple of minutes' time.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Andrew Bryson is a portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. And I can't remember for the life of me what the record close of the all share index on the JSE has been. I know it's above 68,700, but I don't have the precise number. Do you have a number on demand for me, Andrew Bryson? Or do I need to frantically Google while we talk about it?
You might need to frantically Google, Bruce.
The fact that you don't know it. Now, this is important. Okay. While I Google, the fact that you don't know it suggests to me that it's just a number, and actually the absolute number of the all-share index, whether it's at 68,700 or 68,500 or 69,000, doesn't bother you that much. It's not something that keeps you awake at night.
No, I wouldn't say so, Bruce. I think, what we're watching is what a very bullish market, and I think, we're now catching up to the environment that we've seen for a while overseas. It's hard to comprehend the sort of place we were in March last year when you look at how strong markets are at the moment and how much, sort of positive sentiment there is.
It's an astonishing amount of positive sentiment, and it befuddles a lot of people and confuses a lot of people. And it's always worth explaining in some detail why it is that the JSE is so incredibly resilient in such a negative economic and social environment as South Africa portrays.
Yeah, so look, I think firstly what we've seen coming out of the crisis last year is record amounts of liquidity that was pumped into the system, and I think everyone is sort of well aware that, asset prices have benefited from the sort of wash of cash that's flowed into markets. I think in South Africa's case, we've also been a beneficiary of commodity prices that have really been on the charge over the last sort of year. And so our mining companies have really, benefited a lot, together with probably Naspers, but certainly resources have been the standout performer.
Well, certainly have, and it's hard to believe that we're still such a resource-dependent economy for all of the progress that has been made on the JSE. I was asking both John Perlman on 702 and John Matham on Cape Talk today about how many gold companies were listed in the top 40 of the JSE in February 1990. And I chose that starting point purely because it was the day Nelson Mandela was released from jail, and it was just a nice point to choose from. So let's test you, Andrew Bryson. How many gold companies were in the top 40 of the JSE on the day Nelson Mandela was released from prison?
I must admit, Bruce, I did hear you earlier, and I heard it was 33 or so. But
correct.
I was quite surprised. I would have not. I would have gone with John's guess and said less than 10. But it just shows how the market makeup has changed.
It has, and it has changed, and it is restructured fundamentally. And there are, you know, the mining companies are still dominant, and they're still some of our biggest global players and most successful earners. And we're still massively dependent. I mean, as you know, our pension funds depend on Naspers and resources companies predominantly, less so even on the cell phone companies and banks.
Yeah, no, sure, Bruce. And I think, you know, it's interesting at the moment. I mean, the mining companies almost seem to be getting a sort of, you know, second wind. And I think a lot of that's coming from, firstly, huge infrastructure spend that's expected to come through, particularly in the U.S. But also as countries move to electric vehicles, for example, that are quite highly commodity intensive. So, you know, I think we've been well placed to benefit from that, with our exposure to that market.
Yeah. What is pushing the JSE higher? I mean, I think we are within 100 points of a record level. That's my obsession, not yours. But what is pushing the JSE higher?
Well, I mean, we've spoken about it. I mean, certainly the mining companies have dominated this year. And then I think second round, we've seen some of the SA Inc. shares starting to come to the party now. I think it's just a really positive environment for equity markets globally at the moment. And it's not necessarily unique to South Africa, but we are certainly one of the markets that's standing out. I was chatting to a colleague, and he was saying in dollars, we're actually one of the best performing markets in the world at the moment.
We are. I mean, in dollar terms, we are, which is, again, one of those great counterintuitive factors. When I last checked, the Dow was up about 15% over the last 12 months. The FTSE was flat and we were up 30%. And that's, I mean, that would have changed slightly since I last looked a couple of weeks ago. But yeah, it's a weird phenomenon to see the solid, really solid performance of the JSE over this time. A couple of trading updates today. Ital Tiles trading update coming out and showing, you know, we saw this phenomenon develop during the lockdowns and people got tired of the four walls and the floors around them. So they went and bought tiles and paint and stuff and started doing renovations. Ital Tiles trading update today shows that has gone beyond last year. People are still obsessed with making their environments more attractive.
Yeah, absolutely, Bruce. I think if I'm not mistaken, I think they're up. The sales were up 18% for the retail segment for 9 months. But, you know, it's a trend we saw in the States as well. You know, as people weren't able to travel, they had to spend their money elsewhere, and a lot of that has gone into home improvement. And Ital Tile, you know, it's a great business and certainly benefited from that trend. But one could also look at a company like Bed Bath & Beyond in the States, which has also been performing admirably over this period for a similar reason.
We saw so many companies taken by a huge surprise by the hard lockdowns 1 year and 3 weeks ago, and it had devastating impact and businesses folded and Edcon died and everything else. But even the hospital groups were taken hugely by surprise. And Mediclinic's trading update shows the impact in the first couple of weeks of lockdown, and that had a negative impact on their first 6 months. But their second 6 months, like so many other businesses, were stratospherically better.
Yeah, I think looking through Mediclinic's results, interesting to note there, it looks like the second half in South Africa was a lot better than what analysts were expecting. And I guess what had happened is, procedures that patients had put off, it looks like they got back into the hospital and had those procedures. And so that second half was quite a lot better. Certainly these hospitals are still struggling with the impact of COVID and, you know, what that does to patients.
Absolutely right. Andrew Bryson, thank you. Portfolio manager at Sanlam Private Wealth. Yeah, the currency held up okay. We at one point we were at like 14, 16 or something to the US dollar. It's a bit softer than that now. Currency never strengthens or weakens in a straight line unless you fire the finance. But yeah, the finance minister, I said, I know I was speaking as I was breathing out. But the US dollar exchange rate this evening, 14.31. So slightly off our best levels of the day, but still stronger than 20 to the pound and close to 17 to the euro.
Michael Pedro, Eyewitness News, Sport.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Corporate and Investment Banking, funding partner to Ayers Holdings and Transcorp for their $1.1 billion acquisition of OML17. That's African Asset. Absa is a registered FSP.
This is The Money Show. I'm Bruce Whitfield. On the next Money Show, retired Judge Dennis Davis, who's joining SARS as a consultant, joins us for our Other People's Money feature. He's been immensely vocal on tax and always talking about other people's money. So now let's talk about his. Also, top business stories of the day and pushing for the best book of the year so far. Next time on The Money Show.
702.
Bruce is on The Money Show.
So when I was a kid, nougat was a stuff that you found in the cafe, in the corner shop. And it came in blue and white plastic. And for the life of me, I cannot remember the brand, which is probably a good thing because maybe the horrible stuff is still being made. But it was white. It was sickly sweet. It was sticky. And whenever you opened the packet, it was just stuck half to the packet into your, it was just an abomination. It had red and green glacé cherries in it, and occasionally would have some nuts in it. It was pretty horrible. So Sally Williams comes along, and she has a look at the South African nougat market, and she goes, there's a gap. And so she doesn't invent nougat, but what she does is she, I think, pretty near perfects it. She traveled a lot and she knew good nougat from bad, and she sampled so much in markets in the Middle East, and she came home to her kitchen in Joburg and she set about developing her own version. And since then, there have been many, many imitators, but I think there's still only one Sally Williams nougat. The managing director of Sally Williams Fine Foods is Mark Sack, who joins us on the line this evening. Is the recipe still the same, Mark? I mean, have you stuck true to Sally's kitchen recipe?
Evening, Bruce. Thanks for the opportunity. The answer is most definitely yes. It hasn't changed one iota in the 22 years since we've been open.
And nougat's still very much at the center of everything as far as the Sally Williams business is?
Yes, it's our core business, although we do also manufacture products such as Turkish Delight. We coat both nougat and the Turkish Delight range with Belgian chocolate, but the mainstay still would be the nougat.
And you went into ice cream at some point. Have you stuck with ice cream? I think it's quite a hard category, isn't it?
Yeah, we did go into ice cream, albeit with I went into a partnership that unfortunately didn't work out, but we will be back. So that's definitely on the radar for the not too distant future.
Okay, well, I mean, nougat is, I mean, it's nothing simple, of course, and there's branding and marketing and packaging and distribution and all that sort of stuff. Ice cream is a bit like a vaccine. If you don't keep it at the correct temperature and deliver it and keep your cold chain intact, then it spoils and it's not much use to anyone. And was that one of the considerations, or was it simply a business arrangement that didn't sort of function?
It was a business arrangement, unfortunately, that went pear-shaped. Although having said that, confectionery, such as confectionery which we manufacture, also needs to be in a cold chain that is maintained quite strictly.
Mm. What do you learn from that? I mean, do you learn that you actually need to get your own ice cream factory going, or do you learn that you need different partners? What's the big learning?
Yes. So we did have an ice cream factory that manufactured for our own branded stores. So there certainly was an advantage because you could control the cold chain from beginning to end. And yeah, that worked. That certainly worked well for us. And there were lessons in it nonetheless.
Mm. And nougat, I mean, as we say, it's at the center of everything. Is nougat still as popular as it ever was?
Bruce, I'd say affirmative to that. We had our best year ever last year and looking to have an even better year this year. A lot of what we do and produce is exported and found in some of the, what I'd like to think, the most famous stores in the world. And
where?
We certainly
Name names. Name names here, Mark. Name names. Come on.
So Costco, Trader Joe's. We've been in Selfridges. We've been in Harrods. In Australia, we've been in Aldi, Coles, David Jones, et cetera, et cetera.
So I mean, you've got a finger in some of the world's biggest retail outlets. I mean, Aldi's there, Trader Joe's is big in the United States, Costco's huge in the United States, Selfridges and Harrods, of course, are at the luxury end, and they're probably a smaller market. I mean, is there opportunity to take those relationships that you've got, say, in Australia with Aldi, and get global distribution? Is that just too complicated?
No, that's definitely the aim, is to grow the brand one step at a time. And the distribution with it. So whilst we still manufacture here in South Africa and export, ultimately it might make sense to manufacture closer to these markets.
And what needs to happen for that to occur? I mean, it would be very sad because, I mean, you've got a big factory, I think, in Joburg. You'd need imminently less space in order to get closer to your markets.
Well, I think that we would continue operating from where we are here because there are a lot of markets that we operate in Africa, and particularly South Africa, our home and bread and butter market. So I guess that would be an incremental change to the business, which would require certainly in a massive investment in these markets that would then cater for manufacturing, as I say, closer to the source of business.
Mm. I mean, I remember in the early days of Sally Williams, I mean, Sun International, for example, would put Sally Williams nougat on the pillow, for example, instead of the traditional five-star hotel chocolate. And that was an important development. But I think the big breakthrough in recent years has been to get out of sort of that hospitality sector. And I'm sure you were out of it in the last 12 months because there's not been that much hospitality and gone very firmly into retail.
Correct. So we've always been very firmly in retail. The hospitality industry and our corporate gifting division, unfortunately, was decimated in the last year. We are looking to start it up again and try and return to our previous form. But fortunately for us, the bigger part of the business is the retail, both what we call modern trade, which would be the supermarket chains, and traditional trade, which would be the mama and papa stores. And we still think we've got a long way to go there as well.
And it's such an exciting market. I mean, and I mentioned in my introduction, there have been lots of people who've sought to emulate what Sally achieved in terms of, hold on a second, nobody knew nougat was nice. Oh, look, you can make it palatable. And then lots of people tried to copy. And more recently, there's been quite a lot of innovation. I mean, products like Mamère, for example, and others have turned this into quite a competitive space.
Absolutely. I think I do believe that we were the forerunners, and there are a number of Me Toos, and it's just, I guess in all honesty, it's just made us sharper, better, faster, more focused, and we realize that there's no real magic bullet here, but as far as I'm concerned, you know, if we continue to innovate and improve what we do, then there's certainly a market for all of us, and certainly
and
for
when
us.
You talk about innovating and doing what you do, but you've not changed the recipe. I mean, when you say innovate, what do you mean? Is it just brand extensions of the original core product?
Well, innovation can be packaging innovations. It could be new offerings for different occasions. You know, very often brands like ours rely on occasions to create a big uplift in sales, whether it's Christmas, whether it's Mother's Day, Valentine's. And I think there's a lot of space and a lot of innovation that we can take advantage of with our current range, but with either a twist here or maybe a new addition of a flavor, but certainly from a packaging perspective, a lot of opportunity.
And when how do you assess the future? What sort of parameters do you look at when you say, hold on a second, we've got this product. It's big in South Africa. It's big across the African continent. It's growing in many new markets. That decision to take production offshore, because that suddenly adds a dynamic and a dynamism to a business that takes a lot of stuff out of your immediate control. And that's quite a big deal.
Absolutely. So I guess the way we view it now is we look at the value chain in terms of manufacturing the product here in South Africa and firstly controlling the cold chain beginning to end from here till it arrives at our final destination, whether it's in the US or the UK or Australia. And there's expensive shipping involved because you've got to ship using refrigerated containers. You're at the behest of an unreliable shipping service at the moment. So, you know, it reaches a point where the money that's going into the cold chain can actually be applied to the production in another area in the world.
It's all about efficiency, and it's all about getting it absolutely right, and of course getting your product to market. When it comes to the expanding the offering of Sally Williams, do you ever go beyond? I mean, the name suggests you have ambitions beyond nougat.
Absolutely. So as I said, there's already Turkish Delight. There's a Sally Williams liqueur that's done under license. We've just launched a Sally Williams honey, which is the honey we use inside our nougat, which is now available on shelf in a number of chain stores. We're looking at a lot of chocolate and nougat offerings in the next 6 to 12 months. So the innovation pipeline is very long at this moment and quite exciting.
I mean, that honey, is it like, is it, I mean, do you treat your honey like wine producers treat their wine, that there's a honey of origin, that there is a, there are hives that are only in this part of the world, or only are blue gum, or only sunflower, or whatever the case might be?
Well, the thinking would apply to everything that goes into our blue gum. An example would be, for example, macadamia nuts. So macadamia nuts are grown locally in South Africa and would be 2 to 3 times the price of the almond nuts, which we import out of California. So one thing we've been very consistent with is everything we put into the nougat is absolutely first rate and first quality. We don't just pay lip service to it. We actually do it.
It's a fabulous story, and thank you for sharing it, Mark Sack. We wish you luck with the expansion. Managing Director at Sally Williams Fine Food this evening. The evolution, thank goodness, of nougat. Have you got a favorite? 31702-31567. Has anybody come close? Has anybody surpassed the dream that Sally Williams succeeded in creating? I remember her coming in, diminutive lady. Maybe there's something in being little, because Ina Parman is also not very tall. And they're just powerhouses of individuals, remarkable women, who've created very specific products in the food space in South Africa. Start off in kitchens at home, learning and trying and experimenting, then defining and creating the product and doing everything that Pablo says before Pablo started speaking about this stuff and really creating phenomenal, globally competitive products. And Sally Williams, just this absolute powerhouse, the founder of the product that still carries her name. I mentioned earlier that the world of art is going increasingly insane. I've never understood why people pay what they pay for works of art. I understand there's only one. I understand that it is, you know, in some cases, is even nice to look at, but yeah, the art world is a mystery. Now, there's been an online sale of a single pixel, and this is this trend of digital art. So it is a single pixel, and I don't know how many pixel in a square inch, but they're not many. The sale online of a single pixel is part of a thing called a non-fungible token. It's by the digital artist Puck, and it is sold for $1.36 million. Now, today's exchange rate, that's close to 20 million rand. Sotheby's somehow managed to convince people to bid on this thing and to pay 20 million rand for a single pixel of digital art. And this non-fungible token, of course, it's a form of blockchain technology, and it's really exploded this year. I think that's probably the safest way of saying it. It really has exploded this year. Prices have been going mad, and we just see people rushing out to go buy these things. I mean, people have got more money than sense, surely. And the non-fungible token called The Pixel, which is the image of a single pixel, there was this 90-minute battle. People were bidding against each other for 90 minutes for this thing that you can't really see. At least that's the way I see it. Anyway, if you understand, you can explain. I would be happy to take an explanation in small single syllable words, please, if you would. Brutal Biz Quiz time on this Friday evening. I would like you to play. I'm sure you would like to play because it is Friday night. And after that, we'll do Eyewitness News and we'll bring you the best bits of the Money Show as well. But tonight on 021-446-0567 and 011-883-0702, let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz. It's fabulous. I would like to know from you the name of the official off-field shoe of the South African Olympic team. South African Olympians are taking particular shoes with them to wear off the track. What is the name of that shoe or those shoes or that kind of shoe? But there's a brand name associated here. What is the name? 011-883-0702, 021-446-0567.
The Money Show.
With Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
Let's play the Brutal Biz Quiz. Eileen in Hout Bay this evening. The official off-field shoe of the South African Olympic team is what, Eileen?
It is the felt schoen.
It is Veldtskoen, absolutely right. We spoke to Nick Dreyer, the co-founder. He's done this deal with the Olympians and the Paralympians, and they'll showcase Veldtskoen, local brand internationally, and is encouraging all of us to go and buy a pair and show support. Make some money for him too. Which bank owns Mercantile Bank nowadays, Eileen?
Standard Bank.
Oh, I'm afraid not, Eileen, but thank you for calling. Keith in Johannesburg, who owns Mercantile Bank? Okay. No, zero response is like, I don't know. I know. Oh. Jeff in Cape Town, who owns Mercantile?
FNB.
Oh, well, you've made it a little easier for somebody else. It's not Standard Bank and it's not FNB. It's not. Nino in Bryanston, who owns Mercantile? That's just rude, Nino. Just rude. I mean, Keith doesn't say hello or anything, but he doesn't put the phone down. Try Keith one more time. Keith? No? Keith's a strong, silent type. Bonga?
Hello?
Bonga, who owns Mercantile?
Oh, I was calling you to answer the Olympic
cheating
question.
No, but Bonga, we moved on. You see, the world moves on. The dogs bark and people walk past and that question is answered. Oh. I know, Bonga. Next time. Thank you, Bonga. Thank you for playing. What about you, Tabelo? Do you want to answer the first question or do you want to answer the one I'm asking?
The one you're asking, is it not Capitec Bank?
You know, Tabelo, thank you for paying attention. Absolutely. Capitec owns Mercantile. They bought it about 2 years ago, the business bank. They're going to change it at some point to Capitec Business Bank, I suspect. And they're growing the customer base. They've done really, really well. I would like to know, ARL, Alpha Romeo Lima, is the JSE trading code for a company that took government to court over service delivery this week and won. ARL is the share code of which company?
Astral.
Astral is correct. Tabelo. Doing nicely. Thomas Chokolo has taken a job that nobody else wants. What is that job? It's in the public sector. Thomas Chokolo wants to be a high flyer. Which job has he taken?
He's taken the acting CEO at SAA.
I know, isn't he? I mean, he's a brave guy, is Thomas. I've never met him. Don't know him. He's a qualified chartered accountant. He holds, and I guess if you hold, you own it, an MBA from Gibbs. And yeah, he's taken on this job. Kennedy Bungani has taken up the chief executiveship of which bank? Tabelo, you've got three tough questions right. I wonder if you can do a fourth.
African Bank.
You are paying attention to the world around you, Tabelo. That makes you the Wizard of the Biz Quiz, a worthy winner this evening. Bragging rights for the entire weekend. You can go and get a T-shirt made, get it printed, Wiz of the Biz Quiz, because you are. Kennedy Bongani is replacing Basani Maluleke as chief executive of African Bank. They call him KGB. Funny for a banker. KGB, Standard Bank, Absa, Barclays Africa, had been executives in senior positions at all of those banks. And then he went into an investment business with Putuma Nhleko. And now he is taking over as chief executive of African Bank. He took over that job this week. Well done to Kennedy Bungane on that.
702.
Bruce is on Twitter at Bruce Business.
Coming up in the next hour here on The Money Show, we're going to be playing you some of the best bits from the week that has been, including a discussion with the beast that we had. Our investment school this week was very good on cryptocurrencies. We had Howell George from Old Mutual. I think you might hear a little bit of Howell George. And a couple of the other discussions that we've had this week are included in some of the best bits. And of course, those best bits are supplemented further by podcasts, which are produced and packaged and put on our platforms each and every single day on our websites on capetalk.co.za and on 702.co.za, as well as on lots of podcast applications. There are lots of places where you can just go The Money Show, and it'll the next thing you can even, you know, ask that your personal assistant on the digital device. I used to do that quite a lot, and then it failed. Hey, Siri, play the Money Show podcast. Let's see if it works, just to demonstrate to you how easy it is. And the personal assistant, of course, is thinking about this. And maybe I've continued talking too much, and that's why she's struggling a little. Hey, Siri, play the Money Show podcast. Don't interrupt me, Siri.
Here's the podcast, The Money Show.
Yay! You see, it works. So you can do it that way as well. Time for the best bits of The Money Show coming up next after Eyewitness News. There it is. Good night.